ea ka aha ho o kolo kolo ki ike hano hano ua a koa koa ho maila. This Honorable Supreme Court is now reconvened.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-22-636, in the interest of the P children, arguing for the petitioner as guardian ad litem, Eitan Aram, arguing for the respondent, the Department of Human Services, Terrence Herndon, Deputy Attorney General, arguing for the respondent mother, Matthew Ministo, argument on the merits.
All right, good afternoon, aloha everyone. This proceeding is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel, as well as on Olelo. And I'd like to welcome our Substitute Justice, Judge Henry Nakamoto, who's joining us virtually from the Big Island today. During the proceeding, because we are proceeding remotely today, should a justice have a question, they'll raise their hand virtually and I'll call upon them at the earliest opportunity. And I'm gonna ask the attorneys to introduce themselves in the order in which they'll be arguing.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. I'm Matt Ministo on behalf of the mother.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Thank you for your time today. Eitan Aram on behalf of Nicole Farelli as guardian ad litem.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Deputy Attorney General Terrence Herndon appearing on behalf of Appellee Department of Human Services. We're appearing on support of the guardian ad litem's application for writ of certiorari.
Very well. Just to confirm, Mr. Aram, you've divided up your time with Mr. Herndon. You have a total of 20 minutes, reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Herndon, you have 10 minutes, and we'll give you a warning with 1 minute to go. Mr. Ministo, you have 30 minutes. We'll give you a warning with 10 minutes to go, and then you'll hear a tone at the end of your 30-minute period and also see a red light at that point. So hopefully we're able to signal to everyone where you are in your arguments. Mr. Aram, please proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Once again, Eitan Aram on behalf of Nicole Farelli in her capacity as guardian ad litem to the two children in this case, FP and AP. I did just want to recognize that Ms. Farelli is in the virtual audience today, as is the children's caregiver since 2021, their adult half-sister on Oahu. So thank you to court staff for making that possible. Your Honors, there is nobody here today that doesn't want to protect the best interests of children. And there's nobody that doesn't want to protect the rights of parents who are in court fighting for their children. But what the ICA did in this case will not protect either. What it will do instead is it will result in remands, do-overs, of proceedings that were fundamentally fair in the first place. What the ICA did in this case is to hold that any absence of counsel, provided that it happens at the beginning of a Child Protective Act proceeding, will result in automatic reversal under the structural error standard, even if that absence was caused by the fact that the parent themselves was not showing up in court. Now, the problem with the structural error standard is that it is a wrecking ball. It obliterates everything in its path, regardless of the actual effect of an error on the proceedings, and regardless of things like preservation and waiver rules, and whether an issue was even raised on appeal in the first place. Now, fundamental fairness, which this court applied in the JH case last year, is a scalpel. It allows the court to isolate the alleged error, determine its effect on the proceedings, and decide if it's worth affording the parent a remedy, even though the children will have to wait years for additional proceedings to conclude. So what this case comes down to is, when do we use the wrecking ball and when will the fundamental fairness scalpel suffice? And the basic problem with the ICA's disposition is that it used the wrong tool. It used the wrecking ball when the scalpel would have sufficed. And as a result, in this case, and in many others, if this case is upheld, the children will be forced to wait years for additional proceedings, even though we can ascertain from the record that this case was fundamentally fair, that there was no deprivation of the process due to mother. And that, Your Honors, is what structural error is all about. Was the error so drastic and so grave that to attempt to assess the effect of the error on the proceedings would be just pure speculation? Or can we reliably assess the effect of the error, tell the fundamentally fair cases from the ones that were not fundamentally fair, and afford a just disposition that way? Your Honors, this case falls into the latter category. We can look at this record and determine that this was a fundamentally fair trial. And so, with your permissions, Your Honor, I'll look at the record, and I promise I'll do this just at the 30,000 foot level. June 2019, the case commences. Mother is not in court for that first hearing. And the court makes a finding that's not challenged on appeal that the children are subject to imminent harm. Under those conditions, the court is not just allowed to act, but it is required. It has a not just a moral, but a statutory duty to place the children with the DHS to keep them safe. The second hearing, July of 2019, mother shows up. The case is promptly continued, and mother is told to apply for an attorney and come back to court, but she doesn't do either. She doesn't apply for an attorney, and she doesn't come back to court for another 9 months, for another 4 months while the case proceeds in her absence.
Mr. Arome, Justice Edens has a question.
Stepping back to that step where the mother didn't show up, you know, the mother says that, you know, parents are almost always indigent and the court and DHS know it. Is it really reasonable to tell a parent to return with counsel when a judge, even one with minimal experience, could plainly understand that the parent before the court is indigent? And in this particular situation, don't you think the judge should at least inform the parent that if they cannot afford an attorney, one will be appointed for them?
Your Honor, I'll answer your second question first, which is that we don't know if that advisement was made in this case. Not exactly on point to talk about whether it should have been made or not because of the posture of this proceeding. We don't have that transcript. But to your question about whether it's reasonable to ask the parent to fill out a form saying that they're indigent, well, yes, frankly, it's not an undue burden, nor is it a
violation. Well, I think what I was asking was, is reasonable for them to say, hey, go get your own lawyer, show up next time, when they may very well know just from their experience as being a family court judge that this person before them is indigent?
Well, yes, Your Honor, I think it is fair. And I think it's a finer distinction than it seems, because what the litigant is being asked to do in that situation is to walk down one flight of stairs and fill out a form and hand it to the clerk so that the clerk can call an attorney and make sure that one is present for them. I think it is reasonable.
Do you think it's advisable for the court at that first hearing, first CPS hearing that substantially affects a parent's right, for the court to kind of do what you just said, but, really make that indigency determination right then when the parent is there and appoint counsel at that first hearing?
I don't think that would be unreasonable, Your Honor, but that certainly is not the rule in Hawaii right now. There is no governing law.
Well, do you think going forward that that is an advisable thing for us to have our courts do?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I'm not here to advise the courts on how they should run, but
I understand that. Do you think a court should make that determination right off the bat?
I think that the court could make that determination. I'm trying to answer your question clearly, but I don't think it's necessary in the interest of justice. And I don't think that the failure to do so is a violation of due process. And just one more response on that point is that it wouldn't matter in this case anyway, because the parent didn't show up. And as a result, the court was under no obligation to assure that counsel is showing up when the parent is not. And that's fundamentally what this court held in JH, is that the parent can be discharged. So assume that is the rule. Nothing changes in this case, and there's no prejudice in this case. We can still reliably assess the effect of the error on this record. And we can, What's more, Your Honor, even if it was error, even if it should have been done in the way that you're suggesting, it doesn't answer the question of whether or not it was structural error, which for the reasons that I mentioned, it wasn't. We can still analyze this record. We can still look at it and say, even if it had been different, the ultimate outcome would not have.
Let me ask you one further question on this follow-up. You mentioned, yeah, just go downstairs, fill out the form. Could the court itself just conduct a colloquy right then and there and under oath, put the parent under oath and engage in a financial means colloquy? Would that be an easy thing to do?
Well, it could do that in general, but it would not be an easy thing to do in this case because mother was not present at the time when that was supposed to have taken place at that first hearing. So it could have done it, Your Honor, at the second hearing in this case when mother did show up, but it still wouldn't have made a difference because she didn't show up to the second hearing. And so had an attorney been appointed at that second hearing, Your Honors, I'm sorry, I got my timeline mixed up. Had an attorney been appointed at that first hearing when mother showed up, she still didn't show up to the next hearing. And as a result, the lawyer would not have had an ethical or a practical mandate to act. That's the hearing at which mother says in her briefing that she could have contested jurisdiction. But without mother there, the attorney certainly would not have had the mandate to contest jurisdiction. And what's more, when mother didn't show up, the court would have been empowered to discharge that attorney because that's what it says in JH.
Mr. Arome, Justice Devens has a question.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Just following up on that line of questioning, when can it ever be harmless when this court in the TM decision said that as soon as the proceeding is initiated, the parent's rights are substantially affected and their right to counsel starts right then and there? How can that ever be harmless error when a constitutional right is involved at that stage?
Your Honor, there's constitutional error that happens all the time that's harmless. I mean, I'm not going to go through the list, but in the normal course, the court does engage in a prejudice analysis. So, for example, you can look at the Loher case, which is the one case cited in LI for how structural error applies in this case. That's a case about counsel in the criminal context. And when it talks about absences of counsel in that context, it says that it's structural error when an attorney is absent at a critical stage in the proceeding. It doesn't say that any absence of counsel is structural error. And I think that the same, I think to use an extreme example, you could imagine a case with an absence of an attorney that we can be absolutely sure is harmless. So for example, if the court convenes and calls this case, you know, in the family court, and the attorney isn't there and the parent isn't there and absolutely nothing happens, that's an absence of the attorney, Your Honor, but it's not a harmful one. And certainly in that case, we wouldn't reverse years of proceedings. So we can speak in extremes, but what it comes down to is how do we choose between the structural error and the fundamental fairness test? How do we choose which one to apply to examine whether there is a need for reversal? I think it's important also to understand that we're not just talking about protecting someone's rights. Unlike in the criminal law context, where more process, more hearings, that's not creating a distinct harm to somebody. But in the family law context, that's not true anymore. Every hearing and every appeal results in a distinct, and I would say a grave harm to a child. And as a result, it's not just appropriate, but it's necessary to consider that child. And it would be inadvisable to say that anytime that there is an absence of counsel, you have to reverse. Because it's not harmless. It's not.
But isn't it true that by not appointing counsel, that could contribute to the mother being absent subsequently?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I think it could, but only if you conceive of the attorney as a reminder service, and you think that the attorney's role is to call the parent to come to court. That's not how.
Well, that's part of their job.
Well, I suppose. If that were the case and that was going to make the difference in this case or any other, then JH should have come out the other way, right? Because you have an attorney that's discharged. In theory, that attorney could be calling the parent, you know, but that doesn't mean that the whole case should turn on that. And if this is an issue of notice, it's important to say this is not a case about notice. It's a separate set of constitutional values that protects a parent's right to have a fair opportunity and to know when their court dates are going on. Here, there's no question about notice. Mother was noticed about that first hearing. You know, we have a proof of service in the record. As to the second hearing, she evidently knew that it was going on because she showed up. The following hearing was announced at that second hearing, so she knew about that one too. And then she showed up at the hearing in November. So there's really no notice issue here. Justice Devens, could it have made a difference? Maybe, but not in this case. And if you want proof positive that this case couldn't have come out differently, then you should look at not just the 5 months when she doesn't have an attorney and she's not showing up to court. So there's a limited range of things that attorney could do. But look at the 34 months after she comes to court. So it's important to note that those 34 months are when all the dispositive events that this case turns on take place. So mother gets her children back for almost a year. She's being connected with services and treatment. And nevertheless, the DHS looks at the situation on the ground and says, mother, who at this point is fully represented, is not able to provide a safe family home for the children. There's a trial. Again, mother is fully represented. And there are findings that are unchallenged on appeal that mother can't provide a reasonable, mother cannot provide a safe family home within a reasonable amount of time. So it's hard to imagine those first 5 months making all the difference in this case. Notice or not.
Mr. Aroma, Judge Nakamoto has a question. Oh, you got to unmute.
Mr. Arome, just kind of following up what Justice Edens and Justice Devens kind of stated, and I know we're kind of analyzing whether it was fundamentally fair and what transpired, you know, while the person was absent, would you think it would be a better practice for the court just to have attorney appointed at least temporarily for the first hearing? Because isn't the first hearing usually the motion for temporary foster custody and the parent has a right to an immediate hearing within 3 days? And if it takes some time to get counsel, wouldn't it be like almost you're not being able to fix that if the party chose to assert his or her right to have a temporary foster custody hearing and then a decision was made and then counsel's appointed? And I know this is kind of going beyond the scope of your case, but just to avoid, you know, the court's having to look at this all the time, right? In every case.
Right. I will agree wholeheartedly with your proviso that that goes beyond the what you have to decide, Your Honors, in order to dispose of this case. Should you decide that as a matter of course, attorney should be appointed at that first hearing? You know, I am not pro or anti that disposition, but it wouldn't matter here because you can do that thought exercise of what, you know, there was no clear guidance from the Supreme Court that that was the rule. If it is the rule, it probably should be applied prospectively since it would be a new rule of constitutional procedure that has never been clearly expounded by the court. But even if it had been the rule in this case, if an attorney had shown up, we know that there's nothing that that attorney could do. And how do we know that? Because what JH says is, when the client is not present, what's an attorney to do? But that's even more so at the first hearing of the case, because when, especially here, where there's an imminent harm finding, there's actually, the court does not have discretion to act in a way that's different. So if that had been the rule here, and there had been attorney waiting for mother, it would have been a reasonable and constitutional course of action for the court to say imminent harm, custody for DHS, and you know what, Mr. or Miss Attorney, you're discharged under JH and no structural error.
Thank you.
Justice Edens has a question. Justice Edens.
You know, the ICA dispenses with our most recent case, JH, in a footnote, basically saying that because mother's case involved a failure to appoint counsel that initial stage, JH didn't apply. That's what they said in the footnote. You know, JH said, look at when, how long, and the reason mother was or parent was not appointed counsel, and that, you know, not appointing for a voluntarily absent parent does not necessarily amount to structural error. Did the IC properly consider or treat JH?
No, Your Honor, and that was a central point in our application, that what the ICA did was reduce JH to one bright line rule when JH itself says that we're dispensing with bright line rules. And it essentially made timing the dispositive factor. Now, was timing a factor in JH? Sure it was. And it may make all the difference in a much closer case. So for example, if you have an attorney who's absent for one day, like my hypothetical before, but that day happens to be the termination trial, then we might think that that's structural error. You know, we would have to look at the circumstances, but that's the point. It's not a bright line rule. So I would agree with the statement that there was not due consideration for those factors. And I know that I'm out of time for my initial portion, but I'll just note this case compares favorably with JH. The absence of counsel was longer in JH than it was in this case. Here it's 5 out of 39 months instead of 5 out of 27 months. And the circumstances are the same. And ultimately what it comes down to is this prejudice analysis that could it possibly have changed the outcome in this case. And I think you can take out the fundamental fairness scalpel and you can open up the record and you can determine that in fact, no, there's no way it could have been different on this record. And that in a nutshell is why structural error shouldn't be applied here.
I'm sorry, Mr. Rome.
Unless there's other questions, I'll reserve. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you. Mr. Herndon, your argument.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel, Deputy Attorney General Terrence Herndon, appearing on behalf of Appellee Department of Human Services. We're appearing in support of the guardian ad litem who did apply or make the application for writ of certiorari. And as outlined in our response, this case presents an opportunity for this court to expand and further the fundamental fairness analysis to cases where parents are absent at the early stages of a child protective action case without the appointment of counsel. This case also allows the court to limit the bright line holding in LI, structural error, to cases where there's a failure to appoint counsel for a party that is present. And again, it has been said several times here, the parents were not present at the initial hearing. And again, we can apply the JH analysis, fundamental fairness analysis, in this case. I agree with Mr. Aram. JH, it can apply to this case as well. It's the timing of it. The timing of when the parents were absent was different. And again, if you apply the fundamental fairness analysis to this case, it's clear that the parents in this case were afforded fair proceedings at every stage. Even when they were absent, the family took reasonable action when it became necessary to take action. So as Mr. Aroma said, parents were properly noticed in this case. They were given a summons by a process server. There's no dispute as to this. The petition and safe family home report were timely filed as well, again, back in June of 2019. And the parents were given an opportunity to come to court and participate in these CWS proceedings. But instead of coming to court, they absented themselves. And what is the court to do in this case? What is a court to do when a parent is not present? Ideally, if an attorney was present, that would be great. However, in this case, the procedure was a little different. I know Justice Edens had a question about the procedure or about the application. When a parent does show up, does that parent have to apply? Yes, they do. At the time in 2019, this is pre-LI, a parent would have to qualify and to submit an application. And that didn't happen because there was no parent present. So we submit that the court acted properly. There was action taken at this first hearing, that's true. But the court has to act when certain things are present, such as the safety of the child is paramount. And when the children are absent, when the parents are absent, when their parents are reportedly using illicit substances and not in treatment, not communicating with the social worker, we have to depend on our social workers who are experts. They're deemed experts under HRS 587A19, and they make those expert findings in their reports and in their testimony. And the court did find imminent harm. Imminent harm was taking place by these children, by the fact that these children were absent and the parents were absent. So the court did have to act.
Mr. Herndon, Justice McKenna has a question.
Thank you. Mr. Herndon, Our cases so far have only really only been addressing the parents' right to care, custody, and control of their children, and whether counsel need to be appointed because of that, because of that constitutional right. But I'm starting to wonder whether it is time to recognize some rights for the children also, and whether, you know, the children are individuals and should have rights also, and whether or not this court, this state should be following the trend across the mainland for the children to also be appointed counsel and not just a guardian ad litem. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Thank you. I agree, Justice McKenna. I agree that children have substantial rights. Those rights have to be balanced as well as, you know, the parents' rights are paramount as well. But like you said, there's individual children at the end of these cases, children that we have as DHS has to care for and have concerns for when possible dangerous behavior takes place on behalf of the parents. So whether or not children are afforded counsel, I don't have a comment on that. However, I agree that children's rights are paramount. And that's really the crux of this case, why we're here today, why Mr. Arum filed his application, because we are in total agreement. Children's lives are affected by these decisions. To upend the case years later and to start all over again and go back to 2019, a time where the case was very different. The mother was actively using drugs. And, you know, I have to say today, the mother, at least in another case, is not doing well. So to place the children in a possibly dangerous situation again and to turn back the clock is really an impossibility. And it's unfair on behalf of the children to go back in time and do that. So the children are in a good place.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you'd finish. Please finish your answer.
The children are in a good place today. They're with a half sister. They need permanency in their lives. And that's the children's interest today. Their rights need to be upheld, and we need to consider those rights. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Herndon, at the July 2nd, 2019 hearing, mother did appear, and you know the court basically told her to come back to the next hearing with counsel. Is that enough in these circumstances for the court to simply give that direction to the mother but not take more meaningful action to get an attorney appointed that day or to ensure that an attorney was in fact appointed?
Well, I'd say if it happened today, I would say that the court can likely engage in a colloquy or have the person or the parent fill out the application. That's correct. And they could do that. They could do it that day. I do submit that. The procedure back then was a little different. Again, it was filling out a piece of paper and going downstairs and coming back with counsel. But again, that was a qualification procedure back then. I do think the courts can inquire with the parent, and similar to a criminal case where a criminal defendant would apply for counsel, it's usually a relatively simple form with their public defender, and the public defender actually makes a determination, to my knowledge, whether that client qualifies. So I do think that the procedure can be changed in that sense, and I do think Your Honor brings up a good point that the application procedure can change as well.
Justice McKenna has a question. Justice McKenna.
Mr. Herndon, Mr. Arum pointed out that, and I'm wondering if this is true, I don't see in the record where there are transcripts of those hearings. It appears that the only transcript that was requested was as of the actual trial itself. And it appears that we're here on this issue because the ICA took plain error notice and ordered supplemental briefing, but I don't see, were the transcripts ordered?
No, Your Honor.
So do we even know what the judge said at these hearings as to the counsel issue? We're just looking at orders, right? we're not seeing what the judge actually said. We don't know whether the judge said, please go downstairs. You need to fill out this form. Counsel will be appointed to you if you can't afford one. So we actually don't know what was said. Is that right?
That is correct. They weren't requested by any party to this case. And going back in time, I wish I had done that. But at this time, the record is based on the orders and the minutes and what the court sees. So no, we don't have transcripts or recordings.
Thank you.
Please continue if you have other
questions. Thank you. So I know I have very brief, limited amount of time. So I would ask the court to do not apply structural error in this case and apply the fundamental fairness doctrine in this case. Applying that test, this case passes with flying colors. Every time mother showed up without counsel, no action was taken. Case was simply continued. The mother was advised to apply for counsel and come back with counsel. No substantive action was taken when mother appeared. It's only when mother did not appear that substantive action was taken, but again, for good reason, to protect the children. So I would ask the court to simply accept or remedy this case by granting the GAL's application, vacate the judgment of the Intermediate Court of Appeals, and affirm the orders of the family court. Thank you for your time.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Herndon. Mr. Ministo, your argument.
Yes, may it please the court. First, I apologize for introducing myself out of order. I think I stepped on Mr. Aram's shoes. I apologize. Second, sure. I think trial court counsel Leslie Matthews is paying attention. I wanted to give her credit. She's doing a good job with the trial court, even though I'm handling the appeal. But with that in mind, I think I wanted to address a couple of things that Mr. Aram mentioned. He kept mentioning that the findings of fact weren't challenged with the trial court. And that kind of gets to what my initial point on appeal was, that she had a bunch of post-trial motions she wanted to file within the time limit for a motion for reconsideration. And that's another issue, that she wasn't appointed counsel because her trial court counsel at the trial refused to pursue an appeal and then did not want to pursue post-trial motions. This isn't collateral appeal. This is a separate point. So there's a lot of stuff that could have been raised. We could have raised these issues. We could have had the transcripts. We could have had more adequate briefing on this if counsel was appointed after the termination. And instead, what happened is father withdrew because he didn't want to pursue an appeal, and then no counsel was appointed. And that's how she got stuck with me. So I did want to address that. I think certain deficiencies in the record are a direct result of that, and sort of highlight a lot of the glitches that we had with the trial court in this case. I also want to note that, something that's missing that hasn't been addressed yet is, shortly after this petition was filed, her children were taken from her. The children were ordered to go into foster custody a couple of weeks after this was filed. Frankly, it's not clear why or how that affects the merits of the case, whether she's likely to succeed or not, but I don't think that the state of Hawaii or this court should be in the business of, letting trial courts get away with taking parents' children away from them through foster custody without appointing them counsel. That's an important point. And maybe it's secondary to the likelihood of success on the merits, but it's an important point. And I think that's the procedure recommended by Mr. Aram. I think when I mentioned that, segues into other problems with that. As this court recognized in TM, the case-by-case process kind of creates problems, right? It doesn't lend itself to good judicial review. It doesn't provide a good standard for people to work off of in the trial courts. So I think that that's something that's important for this court to consider. And particularly in these cases, trial court judges, my experience is they're all caring, capable people, but sometimes they get impatient with parents. Parents who have difficulty raising their children aren't the most sympathetic. And sometimes that can lead to decisions that are a bit rash, and allowing foster custody to proceed without appointment of counsel kind of hints to trial courts they might get away with that sometimes. And I don't think that's something that we want to be in the business of doing.
Mr. Minister, Justice McKenna has a question.
Oh, yes.
Thank you. So I just wanted to make sure I understand. You're proposing that even before any hearing, if even if there's like an emergency removal, counsel needs to be appointed before children are ever removed? Is that what you're arguing?
Well, I believe that that's what the Supreme Court precedent already requires. I do believe that that would be appropriate. But I may be a little more willing than Mr. Aram to recommend things to this court, but, you know, I'm not the ultimate decider. I do believe present custody does require, present case law does require but that.
I should have phrased it this way. Are you indicating that even if the client, the parent, does not appear, counsel needs to be there and be representing the parent, even if the parent defaults, which is what we actually ruled on, I believe, in JH.
Well, I'd submit that this is a little bit different from JH for a couple of reasons. I mean, first is this is just the case getting started. You know, they haven't had a chance to meet with counsel yet, right? This is for a lot of parents, this is going to be their first run-in with the DHS CPS system, right? So they might not understand what's going on. So I do think there is a basis for making a distinction between the JH case and in this case. And likewise, I think this sort of segues into the reasonable efforts analysis. I think that when there's a delay in counsel at the beginning of a case, it's hard for the government, it's hard for a court to confidently say, and it's hard for an appellate court to confidently say that reasonable efforts have been made, because although that duty's out there, the duty to show that there aren't reasonable efforts, that falls on the parent to complain about. So if a parent's not given counsel at an early stage of a proceeding, like in this case, where it's 4 to 5 months, if there's no reasonable efforts, that the clock is ticking against them that whole time, and there's no one on the record for them to say, look, where's my services, right? So in contrast with the JH case, right, I mean, they had an attorney, they had someone who could have complained with them, they just stopped showing up, right? They've already had a chance to proceed, right? So I think that there's a meaningful and real distinction between JH and the case that's before this court.
So are you basically asking us to make LI retroactive to 2019?
I think I might defer to the court on that. I think that Mr. Aram correctly stated the he may have correctly stated the standard for whether or not something should be retroactive. But I do believe that the law that was operative in 2019 might actually still counsel in favor of what we're requesting in this case. So I'm not confident that a change in law is actually required to grant the relief we're requesting.
Justice Devens has a question, Mr. Ministro.
Yes.
Yeah, just a quick question. You know, talking about the absence of the mother, which I think in many of these cases, that's what brings the mother to this situation of, you know, having to deal with the risk of losing their kids. But this right to counsel in these types of cases, as decided by this court's prior decisions, doesn't that implicitly require or assume that the mother is cooperating or actively engaging in the proceedings itself?
I'm not certain that I understand the question. You're saying the right to counsel.
I mean, the mother has to help herself as well and participate.
Well, yeah, I mean, just with respect to this case, I mean, there are indications that she did make efforts, right, in this case to appear. So I don't think this is different from the JH case where, you know, they just stopped showing up. No one knows what happened. She did try to show up for one hearing date. I can't say I'm certain. I can't think anybody can say why she missed other days, but she did make a court date. She did show up. And there are indications she did make an effort in this case. So I don't think that... Yes, I think that answers that question with respect to this case. As far as a broader procedural thing, I do think that there should be some protections for a parent before their children are placed in foster care, particularly in this case where it was for, I believe, 144 days before she had counsel, right? What happens in these cases, sometimes parents will ask, you know, what's the point? I already lost my kids. Sometimes parents ask, sometimes the fact that something's gone wrong sends them further downward in a downward spiral. You know, sometimes that's what happens. They lose their kids and they think, well, that's it. And then they relapse. I've seen that more times than I can count, right? So when an attorney's there to explain to them, look, you know, you have rights and you can get out of this, that makes a difference. So I think that, you know, it is up to the parents to show some ability and interest in the case, but I think mother's done so in this case. And likewise, I think that an attorney really makes it possible for them to do so. On top of the inherent, fact that you want it to be fair if you're going to take so much children away from them.
Mr. Ministro, Justice Edens has a question followed by Justice McKenna.
So we're talking about TM, LI, and JH. Those are the three big cases, and we've progressed now to JH. And I think JH pointed out the key differences between it and TM and LI. And I think Justice Devens touched upon that. It's really engagement and appearance, showing up. In TM and LI, both parents actively engaged in that case. They just didn't have counsel then. So I'm trying to understand how this case doesn't align with JH much more so than TM and LI. Can you help me out?
She did show up I mix up those June and July court dates. She did show up, I believe, in the July 2nd court date. And I think that the fact that this happened so early on, I think we could satisfy the standard that mother may actually have kept her parental rights if the court had appointed counsel sooner.
I think what it seems that really JH, what it was standing for was, when a parent fails to show up in court, it's that failure, not the failure of the court to appoint counsel. That's the key understanding. And in this particular case, once mother actively engaged, for 34 months, she had counsel. They went through 5 service plans. She actually, as Mr. Heron pointed out, retained custody and family supervision for a year. So I do see a difference there. But let me ask you this. If there's no structural error, do you concede that this case was fundamentally fair?
No, I would not concede that. There's several problems, as I mentioned, and I didn't even address this point. The guardian ad litem that was appointed previously represented mother in a separate case. There's no waiver on the record. She wanted to raise that issue in a motion to reconsider. Her counsel refused to do so. She wanted to appeal. Her counsel refused to do so. And she wasn't appointed counsel with respect to post-judgment motions, like motions to reconsider. She wasn't allowed an appeal. She had to bring me in. Throughout the case, this guardian ad litem was working with her. And I'm not sure that it pertains to the underlying trial court case, but what got this matter in front of the trial court in the first place is a judge who actually sat on the case an hour after the case, sat all the parties down and helped set them up with the appellate pro bono program, pointing out points on appeal. So there's a lot of glitches with this case. And I also want to note that there's all these timelines that were running against her. There's 5 months that count against her for all the various timelines that apply in CPS cases, right? Who knows what progress she would have made during that interval. There's also a question about whether there actually was reasonable efforts, right? COVID hit and she couldn't get into treatment for a long time. There's a variety of issues that competent counsel may have raised if they were allowed to. There's a variety of issues that may have been raised post termination of parental rights if she was given trial court counsel to raise an issue raise a reconsideration issue. So I think this is one of the cases where I think the quote I highlighted is I think it's unlikely that this case was adequately presented. And that's a quote from JH. I can't say with certainty that this case wasn't adequately presented, but I think it's unlikely or at least highly possible that this case was not adequately presented due to the deprivation, on top of the fact that she was just deprived of her kids for 4 months without an attorney. So I think if you have to err in a situation like this, you have to err on the side of caution in ensuring that mother is granted counsel.
Justice McKenna, your question followed by Judge Nakamoto.
Thank you. If we were to rule that N. Ray L.I. was a new rule of constitutional interpretation and did not have retroactive effect, it was decided in 2021, so it did not apply to this situation in 2019. And then if we rule that J.H. Controls here, and we set aside the ICA's judgment on appeal, would we then remand to the ICA to address some of these points that you actually did raise on appeal? I noticed that your points of error that were that you allege were included the things that you've just said?
I do believe that, I do think that some issues would have to be addressed on remand. I do think LI is consistent with JH, though. I don't think that LI and JH are inherently inconsistent. And I think the common thread between the two is whether...
My hypothetical was assuming that we rule this way.
Okay.
Then,
so
would we then remand to the ICA?
Okay. I believe you may have to remand to the ICA, and the ICA may actually have to remand to the trial court, actually, if that is how you rule. You've thought further ahead on that point than I have, Justice McKenna. But I think that these may ultimately be issues for the trial court. But
are you seeking for us? Perhaps we can rule on the issues on appeal, the additional issues that you raised on appeal.
Sorry, what was the question, Your Honor?
I'm wondering whether we should just go ahead, if we rule that there was no structural error here, whether we should just go ahead and address the issues that you've raised on appeal in the briefing, because, you know, these child cases, these child welfare cases, we don't want all this delay happening in terms of cases going down and up and up and down. So perhaps it might behoove everyone's interest for us, this court, to go ahead and address the issues.
Just as a side note, there's in these child cases, I mean, it's sort of taken as the gospel that delay is inherently bad for the kids. And I can't tell you how many cases I've had where delay has worked to the kids' advantage. JH, for example, it overruled the JM and ZM case. And I was trial counsel in that case. I mean, the JM and ZM case was overruled. The parents were doing terrible when the TPR case happened, but because of the appeal a year later, the parents were doing fine. No one ever saw them again. So it may be beyond the scope of oral argument now, but I do want to at least, you know, call into question the notion that in every case, inherently, further delay is bad for the kids, especially if kids are with a close family member. A lot of times that actually works out for the parents, the kids, and the family member involved. But that being said, I understand there's a statutory recommendation these cases be resolved promptly. And I understand that it's a deeply sympathetic case, right? Because we have, you know, there's problems sometimes. But so for me, I believe that given that the kids are in a good spot, and this isn't a legal argument, this is just a practical argument based on what Mr. Herndon said, given that the kids are in a good spot, they're with family, I don't think that there's the same urgency to resolve this matter quickly as there is with some cases where they're with foster care with some unknown family.
Judge Nakamoto, your question.
Okay. I know we had some discussion about the 144 days where mother did not have counsel. So is it your position that because of that, there was structural error and in this case, orders terminating parental rights should be vacated no matter how well mother was doing after she had counsel?
Well, I do think there's structural error because I think that... frankly, given that amount of time, given the stage of the proceedings, there's no telling what could have happened, right? I mean, I think that at that early stage of the proceedings, when your children are first taken from you, it's a strike where the iron is hot moment, right? I think that structural error does apply there and should apply because if that first 5 months went differently, you don't know what would have happened, right? She could have made arguments she could have made arguments that the department wasn't making reasonable efforts. And that could have gotten this resolved in a year or two, you know, like we don't know what would have happened. So, and the second, and maybe more importantly, there needs to be some sort of, I don't know if sanction is the word, but there needs to be some sort of means of preventing trial courts from just taking kids from parents and not appointing them counsel for 4 months. I mean, it's a Kafkaesque situation where kids are deprived of their parents for months just based on allegations, and then they don't know what to do sometimes, right? I mean, to me, aside from the, you know, the more academic questions of the merits and the job of this court to review something on appeal, just as a practical matter, it's too rife for abuse and negligence to allow that sort of thing to happen. So I do think it should be a structural error.
Okay. And it doesn't matter if, hypothetically, if mother had family supervision with the children for a year, 2 years, 3 years. It doesn't matter. At that point, would it have to be a redo if ever the kids were taken away?
Well, I mean, I believe under case law, I mean, the counsel needs to be appointed under family supervision, with family supervision or foster custody is requested. So for me, my argument is that it's at the commencement of the case where it's most important. If mother, I think the hypothetical that Your Honor is presenting is that mother's in family supervision for a year and then.
So I guess my, to be clear, is like she had no counsel. The children got taken away. She got counsel. She did well. And then the kids were taken out of foster custody, given with mother for 1 year, 2 years or whatever it is. And then mother had a relapse. But at any point in time, there's structural error and there's no saving the case, so to speak. And we'd also have to redo.
Well, I think that's different because by that point, I mean, she's had counsel for a while. She's had a chance to advocate for her reasonable efforts inquiry. She's a chance to do the services. There's more involved at that point. It's not when the iron's hot, I think, is what I would say. But I mean, as Mr. Aram said, I mean, it could be that, you know, if there's a hearing on whether foster custody should be appointed and she doesn't have counsel, even if it's for a day, I would submit that, I mean, that's probably structural error, right? I mean, if there's a hearing on whether foster custody is going to be granted, I mean, she needs counsel for that. I mean, I think that would be structural error in my position. But if, you know, she's absent for 6 months in the middle of the case, I mean, I think that's the situation contemplated by JH.
Okay, thank you.
Exactly what should the court have done in this case under your view? Is it at the first hearing it should have appointed counsel when she came in on July 2nd? What exactly should the court have done differently from your point of view?
My point of view is that counsel should have just been appointed as soon as the petition is filed. That makes it easier, right? So she can, that counsel can then contact the client. I'm not saying that, you know, a lapse of 15 minutes or something or a day automatically gets rid of it. I mean, I think that there's a common sense implicit in all the operative case law. But I mean, to me, I think the case law stands for the proposition that, you know, as soon as a petition's filed and family supervision is requested or foster custody is requested, then counsel should be appointed. And
before she appears in court. So
I mean, that's the position I'm arguing, just because, and again, this goes back to the reasonable efforts. I'm sorry if I interrupted, Your Honor.
No. I'm just trying to understand exactly what you envision. So as soon as the petition is filed, a counsel would be appointed and that counsel would have an obligation to reach out to mother, or how would that work?
That's what I'm arguing is required under case law. And again, I might be getting a bit ambitious, but I do think that the reasonable efforts inquiry, I think part of that, it wouldn't be that hard for the department to opine on whether a parent is indigent. They do months of investigation before this happens. I'm not excited about telling Your Honor what to do, but I mean, that would work, you know. to me, it looks like the case law seems to say that, seems to support that counsel should be appointed upon filing of the petition, because there's substantial rights implicated at that point. Even, you know, they start their investigations continuing. Mother might say something, you know, mother might not understand the impact of what she does on the case. So that's kind of my understanding.
And if counsel's not able to establish contact with mother and mother doesn't appear at the first hearing, what should happen then?
Presuming counsel intended or attempted to contact mother and mother's not present at the first hearing. If counsel's there, I guess the first question is that it's happened more than once, at least to me, and I think it's happened more than once to most people who do these cases. Sometimes the mother can't be found. Like a lot of times they're homeless, right? So I do think there would have to be, if a parent is homeless, it's hard to fault her for not appearing to court. It's hard to discharge her attorney if, you know, her attorney wasn't able to contact her. So, I mean, at some point, if some period of time, you know, maybe the analysis changes, but that's what I envision. I apologize for envisioning a lot, Your Honor. I understand that this court makes the decision. So
no, Okay, thank you. Carry on with your argument if there are other points you'd like to make.
Yeah, I believe, I guess I just conclude with that. You know, I think that, as I mentioned, sort of taken as a gospel that delay is inherently bad for kids. And it, obviously a lot of times it is, but there are times when it's not the end of the world. And actually it works to everybody's, it works in everybody's interest. Because of that, I do think, and because of the fact that, you know, this person's parents were just taken, you know, a parent's children are just taken from them, right? And that's something that shouldn't happen for months without appointment of counsel. And I think in this case, I think it's pretty clear that it is unlikely that the case was adequately presented. And there is a chance, whether it's small or big, I do think there is a chance that mother may have kept her parental rights if the court did appoint court-appointed counsel sooner. So I do think that that supports affirming the ICA's decision. I don't have anything else. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ministo. Mr. Arome, your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to make 3 points in rebuttal. First, I want to address the idea that there were glitches in this case. Second, I want to address this point about when counsel should be appointed. And third, I want to get to Mr. Ministo's point about delay can actually be beneficial for children. So first, on the point about the glitches, I mentioned that findings of fact were not challenged on appeal in this case. Now, that's true. None of the issues that were raised in the ICA were about findings of fact, including the reasonable efforts finding. And there was no cross application for certiorari filed. So those findings are undisturbed and unchallenged. As far as the points that were raised in the ICA briefing, Justice McKenna's question is important. What do you do with them? The fact is that those issues are waived. Those issues were not raised in an application for certiorari. The ICA looked at this case and said and ignored those issues. And the ICA's disposition wasn't challenged. There was no application filed saying, well, you know, these are additional points you can look at. Now, to the extent that your honors think that these are important issues to address at the Supreme Court level, I think that, you know, I wouldn't say that these should be remanded. I think there are issues of law that can be decided here. And just very briefly, the guardian ad litem issue is very clearly waived, wasn't raised at all. And on the discharge issue, I'm sort of confused by that because if you look at the record, you can see that the motion for discharge was filed on October 25th, 2022, and Mr. Ministo appears and files a notice of appeal on October 26th. There was not a day that mother was without counsel following the termination. On the question of when counsel should be appointed, I certainly think the answer is not before children are taken away, because there are exigent circumstances, for example, when the police arrive on scene and that child might be alone or the parent might be incarcerated. The police officer is authorized by law to take custody of that child and hand it over to DHS. That rule is not workable. This is an important question, and clarity can only help the family courts. But it's important to understand and think about existing cases in the system that could be disturbed where the parent did get a fundamentally fair trial. And what's more, it's not dispositive of this case, because had appointment been required in this case earlier than it was made, it would not have changed the outcome. And nonetheless, mother has a fundamentally fair point. I know I'm short on time. I just want to address this point about delay. When certainty is delayed for a child, for these children are wondering, where am I going to go to school next year? What island am I going to live on? And who is going to be my mom? I can't speak to the gamut of cases that Mr. Ministo has litigated, but in this case, this family is suffering from uncertainty. This is not LI. There's no guessing about what would have been different. There's no record that was generated by a parent who was in court fighting for her rights. Your honors can look at this case, and this case can end today, because your honors can decide based on the record that nothing could have changed. The outcome would not have been different. Now, Your Honors, in conclusion, it's time for this litigation to be over so the children can get the certainty that they deserve. Mother had the assistance of counsel from the moment that she started appearing in court, and there's nothing that the family court can do on remand that would afford mother meaningful protections that she did not have access to the first time around. It does not make sense to afford mother a do-over while these children continue to wait in uncertainty for years. 5 years is long enough. The court should vacate the ICA's opinion and reinstate the termination judgment so that these children can move on with their lives and join their permanent family as soon as possible. Thank you for your honor's time. That's all I have, unless there are any questions.
Right. I want to thank all of our counsel for your appearance today. And on behalf of the court, thank Mr. Arome for participating on a pro bono basis as part of our appellate pro bono project. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Ua ho'oku'u ia mai ne kea aha ho'okolokolo ki'eike hanahano o kumoku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.